Hello, this is Deborah Harper, president of Psych Journey. Welcome to the Psych Journey Audio Book Club, www.psychjourneybookclub.com. Most of us grow up knowing who we are and where we come from. Lisa Author's mother hailed from New York, her father from Virginia, and every day they reenacted the Civil War at home. Our guest, Ms. Lisa Author, author of Kin Folks, Falling Off the Family Tree, The Search for My McGlynn Ancestors, published by Arcade Publishing, will share her quest to understand her family heritage and decode family secrets. Lisa Author was born in 1944 in Kingsport, Tennessee, where she went to public schools. She was graduated from Wesley College with a BA in English Literature in 1966. After attending the Publishing Procedures course at Radcliffe College and working for NN Publishers in New York, she moved to Hinesboro, Vermont, where she has lived for 30 years, raising her daughter. She taught Southern fiction at St. Michael's College in Vermont and Southern fiction at East Tennessee State University. She is the author of 5 novels, Kinflicks, Original Sins, Other Women, Bedrock, and 5 Minutes in Heaven. Her reviews and articles have appeared in many periodicals, including the New York Times, Art and Antiques, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe. Having lived in Paris and London, she currently divides her time between Vermont, New York, and Tennessee. Visit her website, www.lisaalther.com. Welcome, Lisa.
Hello, Deborah.
Well, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. As I mentioned in our talk before the interview, I've been a fan of your novels for years, and it was, just as an aside, it was so fun in the book to get kind of background on what was going on with your life when you wrote your earlier books. And
Thank you.
Some things about them. So I encourage everyone to also read your wonderful novels. They're a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
So tell us, what inspired you to write Kinfolks?
Well, as you said, the reading line for my book is The Search for My Melungeon Ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first question I always get is, what are the Melungeons?
I'd never heard of them.
Well, most people haven't, I've found, in the country. But they were kind of the, when I was growing up in East Tennessee, they were kind of our boogeymen. We were threatened with them when we misbehaved. And they were said to have 6 fingers on each hand and to live in caves and the cliffs outside of town. And when I grew up and became a journalist, I did a feature on them and learned that they were supposedly living in our area when the first European settlers arrived. And they were olive-skinned and claimed to be Portuguese. And a lot of exotic myths had grown up around them about who they were. And so I met a cousin that I had never known before who claimed that some of our ancestors that we shared were Melungeon. So I wrote this book to find out who the Melungeons were and are and where they came from and whether or not my ancestors had been among them.
You know, one of the things I found fascinating about your book, and my gosh, your book is in some ways hard to describe because it's a memoir, it's a social history, it's a family history, it's also a wonderful history and kind of travelogue about how the United States is so different in different areas. But one of the themes that ran through your book, and I thought you did it beautifully, was you described the same way they're described as boogeymen, so to speak, and when you were the babysitter had scared you so badly, you're in bed with a sheet, afraid to move, they might come and get you.
Right.
But starting there and then into the society around you at the time in Tennessee and throughout the South, they also seem to really illuminate for me some of the really very absurd but very painful distinctions made on race and social class and
absolutely.
The way people hid things from each other or were ashamed of things. They seemed almost like a symbol of that.
Well, that's a good point. I think that was very much true. I think that was psychically what was going on. It was the segregated South, and of course, everybody was terrified of being found to be mixed race themselves, so they kind of projected that outward onto a group that couldn't really fight back. because they were mostly not very well off financially and socially.
Yes, and then also in addition, it seemed like once we think the obvious things, you know, that we've all seen the pictures, if we didn't live there at the time, of the colored drinking fountains and the white drinking fountains of the balcony. But then you also illuminated how these really surreal situations, well, what do we do with Chinese people or Indian people or people that we don't quite sure in these two classifications? Where do they drink? Where do they sit?
Exactly.
Like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Well, in the South, in those years, and earlier, too, I guess anyone with dark skin, whatever its origin, was considered colored, whether you were Middle Eastern or Mediterranean or East Asian, or everybody just got lumped together in that one category of colored versus what were basically Nordics, you know, Northern Europeans, Anglo-Saxons, who were the whites, so-called.
Now, you also said within the social class, and I think particularly for women, is it fair to say that at that time, all across the country, but I think certainly in the society you described, women's status was determined by who they married or their desirability on the marriage market. So being a blue blood or coming over in the Mayflower or having the right Robert Lee in your family line really mattered quite a bit, as I understood it.
Yeah, absolutely. That was your ticket into the, the upper middle class, I guess, being able to establish that you were Northern European.
And so that explains why your grandmother, if maybe you could tell us about her, who, as you described her as taking such pride in her blue blood heritage, there were a whole lot of relatives she just didn't want to talk about, and you better not bring them.
Yes, she grew up in a coal mining area in southwest Virginia and became a teacher and met my grandfather, who was also a teacher. And they decided he should become a doctor, so they worked very hard to get him through medical school. And then they moved south about 100 miles to a new town in East Tennessee. And once she got there, she did kind of a makeover on herself and went from being a daughter of the Southern Appalachians to being a daughter of Tidewater, Virginia, and started presenting herself as a descended from Virginia aristocrats. And we had 14, she and my grandfather between them had 14 brothers and sisters in southwest Virginia, and we never met any of them when I was growing up.
Wow, that's a big part of the family tree chopped off.
So when I got to be an adult, I realized that that was very strange, and that was part of what sent me on this quest to try to figure out who these people that I had never met were. And I found a lot of them, and they were wonderful people, and I'm still in touch with several of them.
But yeah, it was also interesting that way that, again, tied into some of the wonderful things you did about the regional differences. My cousin moved to Georgia about 10 years ago, and being kind of naive, he learned pretty quick that it was not the place to brag that Sherman was an ancestor of ours. He's like a great uncle. So, you know, he's an Atlantic guy. Did I tell y'all I was related to Sherman?
No, not a good idea.
They didn't run him out. They were too polite, but he found out what the total frost in the air was about.
That's funny. Yes, it's fascinating how much the Civil War still lives on in the South, not in the rest of the country, but in the South it's still a almost present reality for a lot of people.
Yes, and I also think in terms of regional difference, I thought you described it beautifully in the South in how family and family history seems to be much more pronounced than in a place like New York or California. And so I can imagine with that as a background, for you, when you kind of, in an innocent way, went and thought, well, I want to explore this, and I'm going to go ask some of my relatives, or even some people, you sit down and you ask somebody if they are, I'm sorry, how do you pronounce it, Millennium?
Millennium.
And these questions weren't seem to be taken with open arms at all.
No, because especially earlier in the 20th century, it implied African ancestry, which in the segregated South was not something that people wanted to claim. So if you called someone a Melungeon, it was considered an insult. So at the time that I started investigating, all of that was just starting to change. There was kind of a Melungeon pride movement just beginning. And by the time I finished my research, it was a sea change had occurred, and everybody was proud of their ancestry, and was even people who weren't Melungeon were claiming to be. So it was fascinating to watch. It was a total shift in attitude, and a very welcome one, I might add.
Well, yes, so that is something in encouraging, that there is that type of empowerment and difference. So could you help us understand? I know always in, it seems like in certain areas of the country, like the South, one's family history and tracing one's family roots is really important. But you've had a wonderful opportunity to live all over the country, it seems like, or at least in well-traveled and also New York and Vermont. Does it seem to you that this is becoming a much bigger hobby and a greater interest to all Americans?
That is my impression, and you're right that it has been traditionally an interest in the South. People are very tied into their ancestors and see themselves as an extension of their ancestors, much more so than in other parts of the country, and that may be because people here are, until recently, have been more settled. You know, you live in the same place that your ancestors have been in for 10 or 12 generations. So you know a lot more about them to start with. And you're maybe on land that they farmed, so you feel a connection. And but why people in other parts of the country are becoming more interested, I don't know exactly. I think we all have an inherent need to know who we are. And of course, this country was settled by people who often were fleeing from something, trying to escape something. So in many cases, I mean, I found this in my own family, people changed their names and changed their history, fabricated a history, and you know, they were trying to get away from something, and they were trying to make themselves safe by becoming by going underground almost. So at some point, I think that all surfaces, and the descendants want to know who they are and where they come from, and that seems to be happening in other places in the South right now.
Well, that seems like a wonderful trend. It's also very encouraging when you went further along in your adventures, that the change where people are, who were once ostracized, are now claiming their culture. You even described gatherings or conferences. Yeah. Where, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think that there were rumblings of a change back in the 1970s. A group got together. There's an area where the sort of the epicenter for Melungeon settlement near a town called Sneedville in East Tennessee, and a bunch of people got together down there in the 70s and decided to put on an outdoor drama. Those are fairly common in the South, historical dramas that are performed in an amphitheater outside. So they got together and had one written about the Melungeon history, and got a local drama teacher and students to perform in it, and it lasted for several summers, and folded because of one summer of gas rationing kind of finished it off. But that was the beginning of it all, when people realized they had a very interesting history and something to be proud of rather than ashamed of. And then in the 1990s, it really took off, I think, with the book that I mentioned that my unknown cousin wrote, in which he maintained that some of our ancestors were Melungeon. That book did very well and sold a lot of copies and captured a lot of people's attention and set people off on genealogical research to find out if they too were a Melungeon. And they started having what they called unions, Melungeon unions, in Southwest Virginia or East Tennessee every summer, or every summer there's been one for about the last 10 years. And people share their historical research and their family research, and some of them have been quite remarkable, with 2,000 people. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they've been, some of them are huge. There's going to be another one, I think it's June 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And it's connected to the state of Virginia's celebration of Jamestown. And it's the theme of the Melungeon part of it is before 1607. In other words, all the people that were here before Jamestown who haven't been recognized in standard histories until recently.
Well, that's another very powerful and very positive, in my view, theme of your book, is that even in these pageants, which often I think were criticized because they were so much one person's view of the world, you know, kind of like Gone with the Wind, I think that the slaves would have written a different movie.
Yeah, right.
that it's much more inclusive. And what do you think the effect has been in your own case of, it was also fascinating to read about so many of us assume just through what we've been told, well, you know, you're Irish or you're English or you're Swedish or whatever. And through the DNA testing, boy, it seems like it's opened up a lot of surprises for people, including yourself.
I think so, yeah. These DNA tests are very recent. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the last 4 years or so. And, of course, what I always wanted was to be able to say that I was Irish or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised believing I was German and Dutch and Irish and English and Scottish and French and Cherokee. And
mm-hmm.
I wanted to be able to say that I was some one thing because I was jealous of my friends that could say they were Irish American or
mm-hmm.
Italian American or whatever. And then I did take a DNA test that gave not like a photograph, but more like a hazy ultrasound of
mm-hmm.
where the blank portions of my family tree, where those people came from geographically. And it turned out to be every major population group, virtually.
You're a true American.
Yes, well, exactly. That was my conclusion, that it's not Melungeon. It's probably anybody that whose ancestors were here in the 17th and 18th century. That
mm-hmm.
it was just a real, right from the start, a real mosaic. And then because the British won the struggle and we became a British colony, everybody tried to be British. But
mm-hmm.
DNA is now showing that the underlying reality is much more complicated.
Yeah, I thought you had these wonderful little stories that just really illuminated stuff. And that things like when you went to Wesley and that very snobby lady, who I'm sure prided herself on her English heritage, it was offering you tea and was so...
Right.
you could share that story that we could... I thought that was...
It was when I went for an interview at Wesley and she... During my admissions interview, the interviewer offered me tea, and
mm-hmm.
I accepted. And I'd never drunk hot tea before, because of course in the South everybody drinks iced tea, but
mm-hmm.
Hardly anybody drinks hot tea. And she said, "Do you want lemon or cream?" And I said, "Both, please." So she looked totally appalled, but she gave me tea with milk in it and a piece of lemon on the side, and I squeezed the lemon into the milk and it curdled. and she politely pretended not to notice, but I was horrified. I realized I'd never be accepted because I didn't know not to do that.
But it's interesting how those little things, like I'm sure that lady, how people define themselves by such simple things, she probably, you know, very much the English lady, and if you did her DNA, it'd be something different. And then then you go to New York, and I loved your line. I'm probably saying it wrong, but how in New York people will just, you know, get a gun and mug you, but in the South, they'll get to know you, bring you casseroles, and then get a gun and mug you. That is so true. In Ohio, they'll bring you a Jell-O salad.
And then mug you.
Yeah. Ask about your family first, and then mug you. Give this to your mama.
But Boston, you know, the people in Boston are supposed to be the blue blood Americans, but you know, the Cabots, who are supposedly one of the first families of Boston, turns out they're Jewish from Florence. They're from Florence, Italy, and their name was Cabotti. You know, John and Sebastian Cabot, the early explorers, were Florentine Jews. So, you know, that just goes to show what our early history is, really is a mosaic.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating because, like you say, you go, just how we make these really kind of ridiculous distinctions. Like, I love the things about how in the South they say you sounded too Yankee, and you go to the North and you sound too South, and everyone felt free to correct how you pronounce things.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's changing a little bit, too.
Yeah, I guess everybody needs labels, you know, for each other to know how to where to place each other. But, you know, underneath it all, I think we're all very similar, even genetically, you know.
Yeah, I think if people are very invested in whatever tiny sliver they've attached their identity to, they probably will see DNA testing as a real Pandora's box they don't want to open.
Exactly. Yeah, no, there have been many people who are very shy away from it very much. People that I've wanted to test.
You know, might I put a swab in your mouth?
Yeah, when I found out about these tests, I ordered a bunch of kits, and every time anybody opened his or her mouth in my presence, I
don't yawn around you, huh?
Yeah. But there were people who were very much opposed to it, and you know, didn't want their careful sense of identity upset. And I don't blame them because, you know, it is kind of it is kind of confusing for a while as it all settles down. Now I love it, but at the time I thought, well, all I want is just to be able to say I'm, you know, Native American or Irish American or something. I don't want to be everything. But now that I have accepted it all, it's very wonderful.
That's great.
Quite peaceful.
What do you hope listeners will gain by reading your book?
Well, first of all, I think realizing that the version of early American history that we were taught in school as kids is not accurate. You know, that this continent was fully populated. You know, I don't know about you, but I learned that it was just kind of an empty wilderness. But
Definitely. You know, Columbus was the first guy on step
foot.
Oh, empty, I'll take it.
Right, exactly. But my research taught me that it was, you know, there were several million Native Americans, and there were also all kinds of Europeans here for various reasons, Middle Easterners, Africans. So it was a very busy place, and all those people, of course, were busy also mixing with each other, and so there was a mixed race pool here right from the start. And I guess the other thing that I'd love for people to take away from it is what I've learned from the DNA testing, which is that there's really no such thing as separate and distinct races, and that we're all hybrids. Not only are we all hybrids, we're all quite literally cousins, because all the geneticists nowadays seem to agree that we all descend from a genetic Adam and Eve who were in East Africa, genetic Eve 150,000 years ago and genetic Adam about 60 to 80,000 years ago. And they crossed over into, their descendants crossed into Yemen and spread out and populated the globe. But we all contain within us mutated versions of their DNA, so we're literally varying degrees of cousin to each other. And I would be thrilled if, you know, that concept started to be more widely recognized and accepted.
Oh, I agree with you. Another thing that I certainly get out of your book that I think would be so valuable to people, and I think it's one of the huge benefits of coming out of, you know, a Southern culture and a culture that values family so much, is you seem to be blessed with, though there were certain relatives or trees that weren't talked about, knowing a lot about your family and being able to even trade houses back and forth that people lived in. I thought if people are fortunate enough to still have older relatives or still living, it'd be wonderful if they made some effort to learn more about the family history while they still can.
Absolutely, because once the older people are gone,
mm-hmm.
everything they know is lost along with them. So,
and there's amazing stories. I think every family has amazing stories. When they get old enough, they'll actually share them with you.
Yes, exactly. When the kids get old enough to be interested,
mm-hmm.
of course, there are long periods when young people, most young people, aren't that interested. But as you get older, you get more and more fascinated by the chain of descent,
mm-hmm.
and realizing how you owe everything that you are to those people who came before you, who were, in many cases, so incredibly brave.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, some of the stories. And I think for young people, I think sometimes the reason they're not interested, they kind of look at their parents as they are now and think, well, you know, what could they have ever done that was interesting? They just go to work and come home and figure, well, when maybe after 21, they might tell you, and you might be surprised at some of the things they did, like some of the great stories your father shared.
Yes.
You know, they weren't always just our daddy and mommy.
Well, it's true. I think maybe that is one reason young people aren't more interested in history, is it's been so sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think that your ancestors are these saints.
Mm-hmm.
And, they absolutely weren't, most of them.
Far from it, most of them.
Yeah.
Much rougher times people lived in.
Yeah, it was really, especially in the southern Appalachians anyway.
Oh, yeah.
It was a rolling frontier. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was just scrambling to stay alive.
Yeah, and I think that that's also true from stories of my grandparents and great-grandparents in the Midwest. I just think there's some amazing story that was just, except for
yeah.
a very exceptional few, it was pretty hard times all over for most people.
Yeah, it really was a struggle, I gather, to survive. And
mm-hmm.
if any one of them hadn't made it, you know, in your family, you wouldn't exist.
Oh, exactly. And the opportunities, because we had kind of somewhat of a similar situation where my father was also a family doctor, and his father died of typhoid when he was six, leaving his mother in the middle of the Depression with four young children to raise. If their whole family hadn't worked together and sacrificed, he never would have had an opportunity to become a doctor. So there were a lot of parallels.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
And they got through by family.
In those years, you know, so many people died so young.
Mm-hmm.
All of my grandparents' parents died, you know, very early. I mean, when my grandparents were quite young. So it's almost a luxury nowadays to have our parents, and, you know, sometimes you think you wish people got along a little better because it is so unusual to have each other.
Yeah, and I think, again, that's another great reason to read your book, because you outline so well, not only in your own family, but also in some of the less fortunate families, like, you know, the Black or the Appalachian, really poor people, that how hard life was for people for a long time and how they had to pull together. And people must read and think, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't complain because Starbucks is out of home. <You know? laughs> I can get over the stress.
Oh, that's funny.
That could be the Bay Area. I don't know. But I do see that quite a bit.
Yeah. No, it is true. It really does tend to put things in perspective to learn
mm-hmm.
history and what previous generations went through.
Well, it's also, you have a wonderful sense of humor that comes through. So it's a very funny story, too. So I can't recommend it highly enough. So could you please give our listeners again the name of your book, the URL of your website, and any contact information you would like to share?
The book is Kinfolks, Falling Off the Family Tree, The Search for My Melungeon Ancestors. My website is www.lisaalther.com, and my I have an email address on my website. I'd be extremely pleased to hear from anybody about anything. would certainly answer. So
wonderful. Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for being a guest in the Psych Journey Audio Book Club.
Well, thank you for having me, Deborah. I've enjoyed it.